I call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. This is a hybrid meeting held with the speaker's approval under House rules. The quorum is not present. I should note, online, virtually, we have Representative Jacob, Representative Burkle, Representative Lislegaard, Representative Heinzman, and Representative Purcell. I anticipate others will be joining us as we go forward. And in the room, we have Representative Gilman, Representative Brand, Representative Ellison, Representative Fisher, and Representative Vice Chair Jordan.
It's early.
I have a name tag, Mr. Chair.
So we are going to start today. During the legislative session, we passed a very large bill with a lot of components. And there was dramatic reforms relating to chronic waste and disease and how that response for Minnesota is administered and actions that were taken there. So we have, over several years, funded research at the University of Minnesota. And we're going to hear first an update from the University of Minnesota, starting with the Minnesota Center for Prion Research, Dr. Tiffany Wolf, followed by Dr. Peter Larson, and then Dr. Michael Osterholm. So welcome. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hansen, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Tiffany Wolf, assistant professor at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine and co-director of the Minnesota Center for Prion Research and Outreach. Advancing CWD research and developing education materials that effectively translate that science for the benefit of our communities are MNPRO's top priorities. We'll begin by summarizing MNPRO's recent outreach efforts around the state and follow with updates on MNPRO's latest research.
Dr. Wolf, if you could just put the microphone closer. We're having a hard time hearing, and it's a hard time recording.
Is this better?
A little better. Try again.
Okay. Better? All right. In 2020, MNPRO received funding through LCCMR to conduct CWD outreach to better reach diverse hunting communities. To that end, we worked with community members from the Twin Cities Hmong and southeastern Minnesota Amish communities and seven tribal nations in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin to gather data on existing knowledge, perspectives, and impacts of CWD. With the completion of that project, we've created community-informed strategies for CWD outreach that are tailored to the needs of each group, including new CWD fact sheets that reflect cultural values and incorporate native languages. We've disseminated these at hunter training sessions and other local events, including tribal veterinary service clinics, the Fillmore County Fair, Minnesota Deer and Turkey Classic, and the State Fair. Through these activities, we've reached over 21,500 people in 2023 alone. We are working closely with tribes on several other fronts, including the development of some of the first management plans for CWD on tribal lands. In association with this, we have collaborated in the establishment of the Midwest Tribal CWD Surveillance Network, enabling CWD testing of hunter-harvested deer on tribal lands. This began in 2020 with the testing of 74 deer by six Minnesota tribes and 1854 Treaty Authority, but has grown to encompass in 2022 the testing of 509 deer by nine Minnesota tribes, 1854 Treaty Authority, and the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, representing six of their member tribes in Michigan and Wisconsin. To date, no CWD has been detected in tribal hunter-harvested samples. The tremendous benefit of this program is the coordination and resource sharing that eases the burden of surveillance for individual tribal natural resource agencies. We are now in our fourth year of surveillance, but our final year of program funding. Thus, we are exploring options for new funding sources to continue these efforts in 2024 and beyond. Our MNPRO staff are also working on a national level in the coordination of multi-state research, as well as translating CWD science into action. MNPRO Associate Director Mark Schwabenlander is now chair of the North American CWD Research Consortium, a multidisciplinary collaboration of academic, federal, and state agencies to advance multi-state research. I've joined a new National Academy of Sciences committee for the review of the transmission and geographic spread of chronic wasting disease in U.S. cervid populations, and Dr. Larson, Dr. Stuart Lichtenberg, and I are participating in CIDRAP's task force on CWD, which you'll hear more about shortly from Dr. Osterholm. On the research front, I'll start with our work on CWD and the environment, and then Dr. Larson will share updates on our other R&D and Preogen. Dr. Stuart Lichtenberg is partnering with several state agencies to conduct CWD surveillance at sites where bucks congregate to mark territory during rut, a promising new form of hotspot surveillance for early CWD detection in new areas. Just this past week, Dr. Lichtenberg presented recent research at an international conference describing the detection of prions in soil from a CWD-positive farm 15 years after depopulation. Dr. Diana Carwin has been leading exciting work on the hydrological transport of prions to the environment. A key finding is that prions are closely bound to sediment and other suspended particles in water and not free-floating. This is promising as it suggests that prions could be easily filtered from contaminated water. A full update on this will be shared with the Minnesota Clean Water Council early in 2024. We're also wrapping up a venison processing project. We've been able to show that common tools like knives, cutting boards, and meat grinders can easily become contaminated by CWD-positive venison, and subsequent processing of CWD-negative venison with the same tools can result in prion contamination of the negative venison. However, we're also finding that cleaning tools with household bleach or peroxymonosulfate, a disinfectant supplied by farm retail stores, are effective in decontaminating these surfaces. Dr. Larson.
Welcome, Dr. Larson, if you could state your name for the record.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, I'm Peter Larson, assistant professor at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm co-director of the Minnesota Center for Prion Research and Outreach and co-founder and CEO of Preogen Corp. I'd like to take a moment to highlight our continued advancements with respect to the diagnostic testing of CWD. I have testified frequently over the past 4 years in the diagnostic utility of the RT-Quick assay for routine CWD surveillance. I am thrilled to report that thanks to continued support of the Minnesota Legislature, LCCMR, University of Minnesota, and numerous external funding agencies, that our MinPro laboratory is now the largest RT-Quick research laboratory in the United States. I'm also happy to report that we have successfully completed a multi-lab validation of RT-Quick for CWD regulatory tissues. 5 independent labs across the United States, including our MinPro lab, performed a blinded RT-Quick analysis of CWD positive and negative lymph nodes. The results of this validation test, as well as those reported in several independent peer-reviewed publications, showed test sensitivity and specificity above 95%, performing as good as or better than current diagnostic tests used by regulatory agencies. In addition to our findings, the scientific community continues to validate RT-Quick not only for CWD, but for Parkinson's, ALS, Alzheimer's, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. The CDC now recognizes RT-Quick as a valid antemortem test for human prion diseases, and the Michael J. Fox Foundation announced a successful validation of RT-Quick for Parkinson's diagnostics this past spring. The bottom line, based on overwhelming evidence from numerous laboratories across the world, is that RT-Quick will help us fight the war against CWD in many new ways, including postmortem, live animal, and environmental testing. Our R&D efforts over the past 4 years have focused on new RT-Quick protocols and technologies that have yielded major discoveries, including multiple live animal testing options, venison testing, prototypes of rapid and portable CWD tests, and herd-level sentinel technology that can be used for the early detection of CWD in both farms and wild populations of deer and elk. Regarding new live animal testing options, peer-reviewed literature shows CWD prions are detectable in saliva within 2 to 3 months post-infection in deer and elk. Knowing this, we have developed sentinel technology that facilitates real-time herd-level monitoring of CWD in farmed and wild cervid populations. We have successfully tested this sentinel technology through collaboration with Texas Whitetail Deer Breeders, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and Texas A&M with confirmed CWD positive and negative ranches. Considering our data and those from the greater scientific community, we strongly believe that the combination of sentinel-based monitoring of CWD within cervid farms, live animal testing, and breeding efforts focused on reducing CWD susceptibility will be highly effective in slowing and preventing CWD outbreaks in cervid farming operations. With respect to wild deer and elk populations, we anticipate that herd-level environmental monitoring of CWD prions will provide state and tribal agencies opportunity to detect and strategically manage herds in real time. Our team of highly talented students, staff, and faculty has invented several new prion-focused diagnostic assays. We are partnering with multiple research labs to independently validate our technologies. For example, we recently partnered with the Norwegian National Veterinary Institute in Norway to determine whether or not our new technologies could help detect CWD and scrapie strains circulating in the Nordic countries. We have successfully documented that the diagnostic tests invented by MinPro researchers work well for CWD testing in reindeer, as well as for scrapie and sheep. Beyond CWD, our assays have great promise for detecting biomarkers associated with human prion-like diseases, including Parkinson's and ALS. The only way to bring the tools we have developed out of the realm of peer-reviewed publications and into practical use by tribal, federal, state, and the general public is to commercialize them through industry. Minnesota has emerged as a national powerhouse for biotech companies, all sharing a common purpose of bringing revolutionary tools to both animal and human healthcare. It is in this vein that a subset of MinPro faculty, staff, and students have successfully launched Priagen Corp., a University of Minnesota spinoff company specializing in prion diagnostic tests and related services. Given increased concern at the potential for CWD to cause disease in humans, Priagen is now offering venison testing options to the general public throughout the United States with a 1 to 2 week turnaround time as the demand for flexible CWD testing options increases and agency testing is not equally available in all jurisdictions. We are also providing post-mortem, live animal, and environmental testing options to tribal and state agencies, academic researchers, meat processors, cervid producers, and zoos throughout the United States and Canada. We anticipate that the expanded testing options offered through Priagen will lead to significant breakthroughs in the global fight against CWD and related prion diseases. Thank you for the time.
So we're going to take some questions here for Dr. Wolf and Dr. Larson. We have until 9:50, so about 10 minutes for questions, and then we'll go to Dr. Osterholm. I should note Representative Schultz and Representative Finke have joined, as has Representative Vang. Maybe while people are getting their thinking caps on, Dr. Wolf, could you elaborate on that 15-year site where prions were detected after closure?
Chair Hansen, yes, this is a site not in Minnesota that Dr. Lichtenberg has been partnering with state agencies and other academic partners to monitor this farm. They collected soil off of this farm where deer had been residing 15 years ago. It was positive. It was depopulated. And recently, Dr. Lichtenberg was able to obtain soil from that farm and was able to recover prions from the soil there.
Had there been carcasses on that farm, or was it just normal operations?
Chair Hansen, I do not recall if there were carcasses on that farm or not.
Members who are participating virtually can raise their hand, and Mr. Strohmeyer will let me know that you have a question. Also on the, with hunting season right around the corner and butchering, could you maybe describe a little bit more of the research that you've found on processing?
Chair Hansen, would love to. So this is some work that was recently completed over the past several months within MinPro Lab. We started by first determining if common tools that are used in venison processing, like knives and cutting boards, could be contaminated if they were used to process CWD-positive venison. So this is the meat, it's the muscle that hunters would be working with and butchering. We were able to show that, yes, when CWD-positive venison is processed with these equipment, we can recover prions from those equipment. We also extended this work to look at meat grinders to determine if the same could happen there. And this is meat grinders that are either stainless steel or cast iron. This is work that is just completed, so hot off the press, really. And we were able to recover prions through the meat grinders. But importantly, one of the questions we had was if we followed processing with CWD negative venison, would that venison then become contaminated with prions from the previously processed positive venison? And that seems to be the case. We importantly wanted to evaluate what could processors do to mitigate this risk of prion contamination. And so we looked at a variety of cleaning products to evaluate that. We looked at routine dish soap, Dawn dish soap. We looked at a product called Briotech, which is a hydrochlorous sulfate solution. We looked at two different dilutions of household bleach. And we also looked at a product called Vercon S, which is the peroxy monosulfate solution that I mentioned in my testimony. And of all of those, we determined that bleach at the various dilutions we evaluated, as well as the Vercon S, the peroxy monosulfate solution, both of those were reliable in removing prions completely from those equipment.
And Dr. Wolf, that sheet is in our packet and also posted online for the public to see. Has there been outreach with the processors?
Chair Hansen, can you repeat your question? Has there been outreach?
With the processors, with the butcher shops?
We are moving in that direction. Again, we have just completed this work, and the information I've provided on the meat grinder has just been completed last week. So our plan is to work with venison processors to get them this information. We're also looking, doing more work on this front to evaluate how these disinfectants impact the tools over time and repeated disinfection. And so there's more to come as well.
Chair Hansen, members of the committee, we have shared this information with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. So that they are aware of the results. It's important to say the research was funded by the Minnesota Rapid Agricultural Response Fund and the Michigan DNR. So would not have been possible without their help.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the information that we're receiving today. It's very, very helpful. And I know that it's being shared across. I know that usually in a lot of places that handle food, they're handled by the Department of Health, the local health inspectors. Has there been any kind of process put together to start so they know what are the processes? Do you disinfect after every time you've handled a deer? What are the type of things that are being done to work with the health departments that usually enforce food safety?
Dr. Wolf.
Chair Hansen, Representative, those are great points, and that's definitely a direction we would like to move in to get this information into the hands of the people who need to know that in regard to making sure that safe processing is happening where it needs to happen. So, yes, that will come. Thank you.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of this is really concerning. It's been concerning, but... I guess what I would, when you informed the Department of Agriculture, looking at warning labels of some sort, just making sure that the public knows more. I think oftentimes we sit in these rooms and at these tables, and we know it, but the public doesn't. Did they give you any indication about any sort of warnings that they could do around rulemaking? Or, Mr. Chair, I don't know if somebody from the Department of Ag or somebody could better answer this question.
Representative Chair Hansen.
Dr. Larson.
No, we were not. The Department of Agriculture did not provide information on how they were going to use what we provided them. And again, as Dr. Wolf said, this is very, very recent results. There just needs to be more time to have those meetings and important meetings to have over the coming months.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm not a physician. Can you tell me a little bit more when you say you found prions that are on some of these things? Do we have any, I realize a lot of this is unknown, how it impacts a human being. Do you have any sort of medical or opinion on what this could possibly look like for humans? Dr. Osterholm, maybe?
I think that's the lead-in to Dr. Osterholm.
Yeah. Tell me.
Okay, Chair, state your name for the record.
Representative, do you want me to address that?
Just go ahead.
This is the great unknown, and this is the challenge we have. One of the things that we have to understand about CWD is that the prion evolution that we're watching right in front of our eyes right now means that what data we had from 10 years ago or 5 years ago may not at all hold today as to the vulnerability of not only humans but other non-cervid production animals or wildlife to these prions. And so right now that is one of the hottest issues in all of CWD is following this. And we do have, unfortunately, increasing information that is in animal models, humanized mice, mice that are adapted to be like a cow, a bovine. We're actually seeing activity of uptake of cervids, prions, that basically we didn't see in years past. So we're really into a new setting.
And with that, Dr. Ostrom, if you want to maybe begin your presentation.
Thank you. Do I do control slides from here, or do you?
These slides? I believe you start.
Okay.
And as you're starting, we will follow up. Chair Vang and I will follow up with the Department of Ag, and this is new information, and we will try to get all the interested folks together to move on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be with you here today. I'm Mike Osterholm, Regents Professor, McKnight Presidential Endowed Chair in Public Health at the University of Minnesota, and I direct the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. The work I'm about to address today that we're involved with is really a group effort in every way, as you will see. But at the first instance, I want to acknowledge the support of this committee in helping this very work actually come about last year in the legislative session, so we are very appreciative of that. I just quickly, to address, I think, the question we just actually had, as you can see, CWD right now is something you're all very familiar with, and it's currently increasing in prevalence and incidence among cervids across North America. It's now in 31 American states and 4 Canadian provinces. The new and existing exposures to CWD prions is increasing in non-cervid populations, including humans. The numbers are only going up. Evolving CWD prion strains differ in transmissibility, disease presentation, and zoonotic potential, which is in part the question I just addressed. Documented transmission to a human or a non-cervid production animal would likely result in a public health and economic crisis. As such, due to the absence of a comprehensive preparedness and response plan for a CWD spillover, CIDRAP is leading an international cross-disciplinary contingency planning effort. We've established international expert working groups focusing on 5 different areas: public health and human medicine, cervid and production animal health, prion biology and diagnostics, carcass and contaminated item disposal, and wildlife health and conservation. The contingency planning results will be a computation of the current and reputable knowledge in the field, highlighting the current state of science and future research directions. A blueprint document directing planning immediate steps to be followed following a potential spillover event in a non-cervid production animal or a human are underway. At this point, we can only imagine it's as if somehow the clock hits midnight. At 11:55, it wasn't a problem. At midnight, it's a real crisis. This product that we're producing will be a living document and updated with discoveries and innovations in the field. In terms of the status update, we're currently conducting CWD literature review to inform project activities. We're actively involved with our colleagues at the College of Veterinary Medicine, MinPro, really keeping up on all the most current information, including the international meeting held last week in Portugal. We've confirmed 10 expert co-chairs to serve as leaders of each of the 5 working groups, which include, and the slide has been updated, now we have 58 multidisciplinary experts as members. Of the 10 co-chairs and 58 multidisciplinary experts, 55 are from the United States. There are 7 from Europe, including France, Spain, Germany, UK, and Norway, and there are 6 from Canada. We have designed hypothetical scenarios to guide discussions surrounding current state of disease and the possibility of a non-cervid or human spillover. As you've already heard from our previous speakers here, the University of Minnesota is very involved with this, as is we have representation from the Minnesota Department of Health, the Minnesota DNR, and the Minnesota PCA. To give you an idea of the level of expertise involved with this, these are the two co-chairs for the Human Medicine and Public Health. Brian Appleby, who is the director of the National Prion Disease Pathology Surveillance Center in Case Western in Cleveland. He, in a sense, this is the lab for human testing in the country. Dr. Lawrence Schoenberger, who is the Assistant Director for Public Health and Chief of the Prion and Public Health Office at the CDC. In addition, the second work group for the Servant and Production Animal Surveillance, Laboratory Capacity and Planning's Response, the two co-chairs are Dr. Jason Bartz, Professor and Chair at Creighton University, a well-known distinguished researcher in this area, and Sabine Gilch, who is a professor of Faculty of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Calgary. In terms of prion biology and disease diagnostics, of which members of MinPro are part of this activity, Brian Kai, who is the chief of the TSE prion biochemistry section at the National Institutes of Health, and Glenn Telling, principal investigator of the Telling Lab at Colorado State University, again, another internationally recognized expert. In terms of carcass and contaminated item disposal, Shannon Bartlett-Hunt, an engineer by training, who has worked extensively in the area of disposal and movement of prions in the environment of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, along with Dr. Deborah McKenzie, professor of science at the University of Alberta, are co-chairing this group. And finally, for wildlife health and conservation, Russ Mason, who is currently a Michigan DNR executive in residence at Michigan State, and tentatively we're waiting for final approval, and Michael Tonkovich, who is the Deer Program Administrator at the Ohio Department of Natural Resources. So this gives you a sense of the breadth of the kind of expertise we have. Currently, we are on target. We are convening our work group meetings via Zoom starting shortly. And again, we already have scenarios developed for which each of the group will react to in terms of what do we know, what don't we know, what needs to be done, what could be done. And in the off chance that we actually have a crisis on our hands, what do we do? In January of 2024, the working groups will continue meeting by Zoom. We'll review a first initial draft. In February of 2024, we have an in-person co-chair meeting to review the comments on the CIDRAP report document. This will be widely vetted. And then in March, we'll submit this back to you, as well as Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and then continue through the rest of the year to update this and also to begin to disseminate it throughout the various agencies. I might add that among the federal agencies, the CDC, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Department of Agriculture are all involved. All of them have membership on these working groups. So let me just conclude by saying CWD is an evolving situation with increasing number of infections in cervids and ever-changing prion strains. If you knew CWD 5 years ago, it doesn't mean you know it today. That's what I think is really an important message to get across. Fortunately, I work with a group of people here that do know what's going on today. While no one wants to imagine a CWD prion transmission and illness in humans and or non-cervid production animals, we must be prepared for that possibility. I am struck by the fact that in the early days of the BSE situation in the United Kingdom, I was involved with those early investigations and how many times I heard from people, don't worry, this will never transmit to humans, only to have 10 years later sitting on top of a major crisis. So I think that's what we don't know about where we're at today. The CIDRAP CWD transmission contingency plan and effort involving now 68 of the world's leading experts on the topic are providing critical review and planning for the future of the CWD response. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll close. And again, I just want to acknowledge the importance of this committee in helping to make all of this happen. Thank you.
Members, are there any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to follow up on a few things. So who is going to be looking at if it's heated, if the meat is heated, if somebody's going to eat meat that maybe there is prions present, does that remove the possibility of transmission? And then also I want to know what happens or if there's guidance that's being hit when you're finding it. I realize that you're testing it with bleach and soap water. Are employees where this meat is being found, are they notified? I want to know more about what this looks like for people working with it in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Chair Hansen, members of the committee, I'm happy to answer the first question on, you know, does heating it render those prions non-infectious? The answer is no. Cooking temperatures do not break down prions. In fact, there's research presented at the conference in Portugal, the Prion conference in Portugal last week, as well as the CBD research conference in Colorado last spring, showing that cooking can actually increase infectivity because it concentrates the prions. And so that's the situation there. Those temperatures are not high enough to render them non-infectious. Also, with respect to your second question, again, this is cutting-edge research, and we would have to talk with the Minnesota Department of Ag on how they want to, you know, proceed with respect to individuals handling venison and processing venison.
Dr. Wolf.
Chair Hansen, Representative, I'll just follow up as well, just to clarify the work that I presented today. This was done in the MinPro lab. We have not done surveillance in venison processing facilities. So just to clarify, these were experimental tests to see could this happen and what does it look like? How can we intervene? But we have not explored or done any kind of surveillance in venison processing facilities. Thank you.
Representative Edelson.
Well, that's concerning. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for having the Department of Agriculture look into this. And then if you could just tell me what happens when prion diseases are present, just in general, what do we know happens to animals or somebody that would be impacted potentially? Can you just tell us what happens?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the issues that we have before us right now is a lack of clarity about how would you even diagnose a case of CWD in a human, or what criteria would you use to confirm it in a non-cervid animal species. And believe it or not, there is not yet agreement on what would be the laboratory testing that would actually confirm that consistent with some kind of an illness, and then what would that illness look like. And so we're basing it on what prions have done in other illness statuses that you've heard already, particularly from Dr. Larson. And so one of the very first priorities, particularly in looking at the human and non-cervid animal side, is coming up with criteria to say, now you know you have a positive test. One of my nightmares is we'll have possible test positivity for which we're not sure what it actually means. Is this really an infection or not? And so this is a very, very high priority right now to determine that very thing. How will it look in humans if we see it in human disease? We surely can hypothesize it'll look similar to what we see with other prion diseases, but it may not. We don't know. We don't know what happens if it is in the blood supply. One of the challenges we have with prion-related diseases is the potential for humans to transmit it via blood donation and blood receipt. What would that illness look like? We don't know. And so part of our effort right now is to define those very things, the state of the art, and say, what will we call a confirmed case? What will that illness look like or possibly look like? And how will we survey for it? How will we know if it's actually happening?
Perhaps we need to have a joint hearing with the health committees when we come back into session, if members think that's a good idea. Any additional questions? Do we have any questions online? Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, I have maybe a different sort of question. And so we obviously see, you know, it's our job as a legislature to appropriate money for this. And then you come back and tell us scary things like that I need to bleach my cutting board and that the soil has prions in it for 15 years. But how does that actually work when, you know, we pass a bill that appropriates this money to MinPro, that appropriates money to the University of Minnesota to study that? How does that look from your end? What decision-making goes into how to spend that money, how it was I find this information to be very interesting, but what was the decision-making process for how to actually channel that money into this research? And how did you determine that this was the sort of research that would be best suited to fulfilling the demands of the bill that we passed?
Members of the committee. There are, in the prion research field and those researchers working with CWD, there are huge challenges, right? So early on in our interaction with the state legislature, diagnostic testing was a major challenge. And so that was the thrust. Like, we knew
legislators were coming to the University of Minnesota asking for help on that very issue. And so we mobilized and then have developed new technologies as a result. What guides those research areas? You know, there's questions. There's constant questions about what we're talking about today. What is the risk for positive venison? What is the risk to humans? How long do these remain in the environment? How do they move in waterways? And really, those persistent questions, not just from the Minnesota legislature, but throughout you know, North America, there's these outstanding questions. Those really help guide where we need to focus our efforts. For example, early on, like, we had no idea how infectious prions move through the environment. And so what we did was we mobilized to recruit and bring on one of the world's top researchers, Dr. Stuart Lichtenberg, with expertise of monitoring prions in the environment. And he is now at the University of Minnesota within the MinPro lab. And so really it's one thing that we've done at MinPro that is different than arguably some other centers is that those research questions, those questions that we're getting from the public and the demand, we are actively weaving that into, right, the research that we do, so then we can have hopefully some answers to people and then advise, right, and what we can do in light of the research results.
Representative Jordan.
Mr. Chair, just to make a point, I think this just shows how much this committee extends beyond what we think of as the environment, maybe like trees and streams and whatnot. The fact that or butterflies, which are all important parts of things that we talk about in this committee, but the fact that the research that we've done here, we passed an economic development bill, we passed a bill that's attracting qualified professionals to Minnesota, we passed a bill that's having impacts on Parkinson's disease and ALS research. And so I think that's important for us to keep in mind is that while this started maybe as a response to, oh my God, a mutant deer disease is taking hold in our neighboring state, has actually had wide-reaching positive effects for the state of Minnesota and the world. So I think it's important that we're thinking through that this isn't just about deer. This is about humans and the health that we're eating, and human health, people who rely on venison as their subsistence protein. And please bring more wonderful professionals and scientists to Minnesota. That is definitely something that we love to see.
If I could add, Rep. Jordan, we recognize that some of the results that we bring and discuss in this forum are alarming and scary. But it's so important. So the work that the Minnesota DNR does, right, with surveillance, it's so important that we do everything we can to maintain that tradition of hunting, to increase people's confidence, right, in what they are consuming. And so, you know, this is really, it's, you know, the research marrying with the state agencies and just to help confront this disease in a multifaceted way, that's really what needs to happen. So thank you.
And in closing, Dr. Osterholm, you know, you've listed a number of experts here from around the country and around the world. Could you maybe elaborate just on how are we investing alone here, or how is what's the kind of the response from other states, and, you know, where's that coming from nationally and internationally, or in the teamwork on reacting to this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, let me just say that the work that I described today was something that many recognized was imperative and needed to happen. No one had just taken the opportunity to do that. And the fact that I described to you 68 of the world's experts, only several people out of all the people we contacted were unable to participate because of other conflicts. So the fact that you could get across the board the world's expertise in CWD to willingly participate in this activity gives you a sense of just how important it is. There was absolute consensus across the board. This is a critical issue. We could be sitting on incubating human cases today. We don't know. And so in the sense, yes, this committee did support on an international level this work. We surely are looking for additional partners to work with us. But again, I would just say that this is Minnesota's lead. You know, 4 years ago, if the three of us had sat up here and tried to share with you the expertise of CWD here in Minnesota, it would have been limited. I think what you've watched Minnesota do is evolve into one of the most important research spots in the world right now in CWD. And I think we can't do it too soon. The implications are huge. So in that sense, we have become a major hub. And the projects we talked about today, again, often because of your support, have made it possible for that to happen.
Thank you. We will probably have you back during session. Next up, the Minnesota Department of Research Resources, Dr. Kelly Straka. Welcome, Dr. Strack.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I believe we do have some slides. Can you see those, or am I running the show here?
You're running it.
You're running it.
It's dangerous.
And you may want to pull the mic just a little closer.
Closer? That is rare for me. Usually it's, Kelly, if you can sit back a good 3 feet, that'd be great. Did I push the right button?
No, just...
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can you see the slides okay?
Yes, proceed.
Thank you very much. Members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today. I'm sitting with my colleague, Mike Ehler, to my right. He will be giving a little bit of an update on our farmed white-tailed deer program on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources. I'm going to get us kicked off talking a little bit about chronic wasting disease in wild deer. So I will be talking about the wild deer. Mike will take it over to talk about farmed white-tailed deer. And then I do have a couple slides I'm just going to wrap up with talking about some of our neonicotinoid research. I did appreciate the conversations we've had already in this committee hearing. I always do. And very, very happy and honored to be following my colleagues at CIDRAP as well as MinPro. So with that, I do tend to be long-winded. I promise you I will try to keep that in wraps today. Just giving a little bit of an overview of our current known status of CWD in wild deer here in Minnesota. We have tested over 120,000 wild deer to date, starting in 2002. We're up to 217 known positives. Now, most of those animals have been located in the southeastern part of the state, but you can certainly see on the map here the distribution of the locations of some of those positives, or all of those positives. We have been testing wild elk and moose since 2004 with no detections. And we have had 13 CWD-positive captive surrogate facilities, most recently last year in 2022. So moving into a little bit of our CWD surveillance plan for this fall, what we're looking at, you should be able to see the map on your screen right now, highlights our CWD management zones in orange. Those are areas where the disease has been detected in wild deer. The gray zones adjacent to those are surveillance zones. So that's where the disease has not been detected in wild deer, but we are certainly doing surveillance there. We do conduct mandatory sampling of hunter-harvested deer in those areas, opening weekend. And so opening weekend this year is November 4th and 5th. So certainly our hunters know that. We have extensive messaging about that. You guys have probably heard it between radio ads and social media ads. As well as direct communications to our hunters. It's all over our websites as well. So one of the things I will say that I am continually impressed with this state about and our hunter base is that our hunters are phenomenally passionate and dedicated to the health of our deer resource, and that is extremely obvious when we look at our compliance. We've been doing this, like I said, for a long time, 20 years, right? And we still have really high hunter compliance with surveillance, so 87% as of 2022. That is really high, especially when you look at other states. And so I'm extremely proud when I travel around, go to different conferences, and be able to say that I'm from Minnesota because we care here. We care about our resources. These efforts are they're a heavy investment, and we know that. So this year alone, we're going to have 239 DNR staff at least coming out to work at sampling stations, 120 students from seven different state and tribal colleges and universities. And we do have voluntary testing options available statewide, so I will talk a little bit about those. The Hunter mail-in kits, you may remember this committee, those that were engaged last year too, we piloted this program in 2022, and I have to say it was extremely successful on multiple accounts. We got very strong feedback from our hunters that they really appreciated this. So what this is essentially a no-cost mail-in kit that hunters can get, no cost to them whatsoever. We're putting together 10,000 of these kits. They can pick it up as a hunter. You can kind of see the pictures here. You can collect your own sample. So we have training videos, training documents that are sent to you, how to collect your own lymph node sample. These are tissues that are collected from right underneath the jawbone. Send it into our wildlife health program, and we'll go ahead and submit those for testing. Again, it's no cost, available to any hunter in the state. One of the nice things is there's multiple ways you can get these kits. You can go on our website, and it can be sent to you directly at home, free of charge. You can also pick it up at our area offices. We also partner with a lot of our conservation groups here in the state. I'll be working this week. Actually, Wednesday, we'll be at an event with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We will have colleagues from MinPro there to help us to walk through how to collect these samples, and you can get kits at those events too. And so certainly this reoccurring theme of partnerships you're going to hear on and on throughout this presentation, as you did the previous talks as well. We also have, in addition to our hunter mail-in kits, we have what we're calling our expanded partner sampling program. We've collected over 8,000 samples since 2016. Now, this is mainly working with taxidermists, some meat processors, but working directly with taxidermists across the state. I have to, on the slide you'll see, I have to absolutely mention the Minnesota Conservation Federation. They really help administer this program so that we can make sure that the processors and taxidermists are reimbursed for samples that they collect. But so basically, hunters can go to their favorite taxidermist, and we have a list of those taxidermists that are participating on our website. And those taxidermists will collect samples for them from their harvested deer, again, at no cost. So this is a fantastic program. We did apply for and were awarded a grant in 2022 from the USDA Animal Plant Health Inspection Service in order to pay for this program. And so this is actually supported through the federal government as well, and so we're appreciated for that. Or we appreciate that entity for helping us with that. That's a $250,000 grant. We reached out this year to, I think it was 563 taxidermists, and we have 133 vendors so far online. So I know the map is a little busy, but you can certainly see the locations of those taxidermists. And it just reinstates how important it is to have these partnerships, because we can't do all this surveillance alone. So moving a little bit, we talk about certainly surveillance, and surveillance for a disease is extremely important. But once you have a disease in a wild population, surveillance alone is not going to manage that disease. Just testing is not going to help. So what can we do to actually try to prevent the introduction of disease to new areas or slow the spread where we know it currently exists? And that's certainly where we put a lot of energy and resources as a state. We have carcass movement restrictions in all of our management zones. We have a dumpster program to get some of that biomass that we talked about earlier, some of those carcasses off the landscape. So I have a separate slide about that here in a minute. Also importation bans. So we do not currently allow the importation of any harvested cervid outside of the state to come into us because, again, we know that carcass waste can be contaminated. We also have recreational feeding and attractive bans. Those are absolutely intended to prevent the introduction of new disease. And increased hunter opportunities. Dr. Larson mentioned earlier, you know, the importance of engaging with our hunters and keeping people hunting. And not only is it an important tradition, but it's an important source of healthy, sustainable meat. And so it's important that we keep people engaged, and hunters really are our best partners here. So we have additional seasons. We have drastically discounted disease management tags, really to try to keep people engaged in the sport of hunting. And we also have a number of those partnerships I talked about. Also with CIDRAP and MinPro, certainly, the Board of Animal Health, and then all of our conservation groups across the state. I mean, we really couldn't do it without them. So I mentioned that I would talk a little bit about the dumpster program. This is a big program for the state, and it is a heavy investment and a heavy lift, but it's very important. We have 43 sites across the state planned for this fall. We're expecting to remove 225 tons of deer waste from the landscape through this program alone. That's, if you do the math, and I'm not the greatest at that, but it's 450,000 pounds of deer carcasses that will not be left on the landscape because of the concern of contamination. And so certainly we work rurally with individual landfill operators and haulers in order to be able to provide that service for our hunters, and it has been very popular with our hunters as well. That program is expected to cost $250,000 this year as well. And so it is definitely a big investment. And again, we do use approved landfills for that. So anything removed from those dumpsters will be taken to an approved lined landfill. Okay, I just have a couple slides left. Wanted to talk just a little bit about the spending. I know I've talked about some aspects of the cost so far, but certainly people are curious and wanting to know what kind of investment have we been looking at. If you look at our total CWD spending from fiscal year 2003 to fiscal year 2023, we're looking at over $21 million. Now, that's a little bit deceiving if you just say it as a statistic, because it is not $1 million a year. If you look at the graph on the left of the slide, you will see a pretty rapid, distinct increase, right, starting since about 2016, 2017, in what these programs have cost. Now, if any members of the committee or anyone else would like a breakdown of those costs, I'm happy to provide that. In the interest of time, I will not do so now, but certainly seeing that we are seeing a rapid increase in our costs every year as we go on fighting this disease. Therefore, it's important that we're always looking to improve our efficiency, and I think it's important when we talk about the taxidermist program, the hunter mail-in kits, the number of sampling stations that we have. All of that really does increase our efficiency. So in summary, and then I'll turn it over to Mike, CWD remains a rare disease in Minnesota, in Minnesota's wild deer, certainly. I know it's scary. It is. I've worked with this disease myself since 2002, so it's a scary thing to face, but it does remain rare in our wild deer. We are very fortunate. Not every state can say that. We have an aggressive approach to protect our statewide deer population as well as our hunting heritage, and we are absolutely committed to adapting. This is a department priority for the Department of Natural Resources. We will adapt as we continue with new science. I'm glad that MNPRO is here and CIDREP was here today in order to talk about some of the new surveillance techniques that are coming out and some of the work that Dr. Osterholm is doing for contingency planning. These are the kind of emerging fields of sciences that help us stay on the front lines against this disease. We cannot be successful in any management here without help from the legislatures, hunters, cooperators, and businesses. So thank you very much. I can turn it over to Mike now to talk about farm deer, unless you would like questions, Mr. Chair.
I believe Representative Edelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know if you could specify just two things. When there is a test that is done, what happens if the test comes back positive? And is there advice given? And then the other question I can ask right when you're done with that one.
Dr. Straka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question. This is a great one. So, yes, the question was about when we do have a CWD-positive wild deer that's detected. So our wildlife health program does directly contact that hunter and notify them right away and identifies what happened to the carcass and what happened to the meat. So we will absolutely take any of that meat and properly dispose of it and then follow up with that hunter. And if there's any carcass remaining in the landscape, we've had staff go out and actually pick anything up that they can still find. So we do follow up directly with the hunters to let them know. Question came up earlier about processors and taxidermists. And yes, while the Department of Agriculture works primarily with the venison donation programs, our wildlife health program does reach out to taxidermists and processors that we know have had positive meat processed through their facilities. We've only had that known one time that I know of, that we reached out to them, and fortunately that animal had been individually processed. We talked a little bit earlier about some of the research that MNPRO was talking about with the new decontamination research that's out there. There was a study in 2019 that looked at just bleach, so not some of the other stuff that Dr. Wolf talked about, but looked at a dilute bleach solution for decontaminating stainless steel surfaces. So we share that with the processors, taxidermists, and hunters as well. The recommendation is about 5 minutes in a 40% diluted bleach solution. And so we do absolutely recommend our folks use that as well. So
thank you.
Representative Edison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then also, if you could just speak to the approved landfills, how is that approved and how are we protecting water and soil in that process? Thank you.
Dr. Straka.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for the question. I'm really looking forward to the Joint Health Committee thing that you mentioned earlier, too. This is a good one. So approved landfills. Landfill is an approved method of disposal right now because the landfills, when we say approved, they're lined to certain specifications to prevent any of that groundwater contamination or soil contamination. So if I know that our FAR friends at the Pollution Control Agency oversee a lot of that, and we work directly with them. Our wildlife health program works directly with them. So if you want more specifications on what means an approved landfill, I'm absolutely happy to find that. But in a nutshell, it's making sure that they're properly lined so that there isn't leaching into the soil or the groundwater.
And I believe Minnesota Pollution Control staff are here if you had questions. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all the presenters. I have a question about not being able to bring deer over the state lines. So I know a lot of folks who go to Wisconsin for their extended hunting. Does that just mean that they need to then fully process the deer in Wisconsin? And is there conversation around taxidermists and processors here of a way to, you know, be able to safely test, or what is the status with the kind of the state boundary question?
Dr. Straka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Purcell. So yes, the question was about the importation ban. And if you do go to, say, Wisconsin or Iowa or any of the Dakotas, you know, and go ahead and harvest a deer coming back into the border, what does that mean? So yes, to get to your question, we do require right now, the main concern with a carcass of a harvested deer is the brain and the spinal cord. That's where we know most of the prion contamination is going to be. So we do require those animals be either quartered out or that must be deboned. Any skull that comes in must be cleaned of all brain material or skull cap. So certainly if somebody goes and shoots a beauty of a buck down in Iowa, we want to make sure that they can just bring back that skull cap if they want to keep the antlers. They're going to do a European mount, it has to be a finished taxidermy mount, or at least all the brain material has to be cleaned out of that skull. So that is the current requirement. We have been talking last year, especially with the Taxidermist Association, on can we start looking at doing something where if you're going to go to a taxidermist, you know, in a certain amount of time, you can go around some of that way, but we haven't solidified any of that quite yet. But we're definitely engaging in those conversations. That is a some of the things that other states have done is allowed hunters to bring things in as long as we can somehow track how they're being disposed of. And that's the most important thing. Bringing a harvested carcass, even if it is positive, into the state, if it's properly disposed of, is going to be significantly less risk than certainly anyone who might just put it out in their back 40. So that's a big concern.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Mike Oler with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Good morning, Chair Hansen, committee members. My name is Mike Ayler. I'm the Farm Deer and Captive Species Coordinator for the Minnesota DNR. And I'm going to give you a brief update on the status of the Farm Deer Program within the DNR. So the first slide that we're looking at here this morning just shows the number of farms that we have that are white-tailed deer or white-tailed deer mixed farms in the state of Minnesota. So I started out with 2016. These come from annual reports from the Board of Animal Health where we had good numbers on the number of farms. And so we had 302,016. You can see at the far right there, we currently have 117 farms. And again, these are white-tailed deer or white-tailed deer mixed. They have to include white-tailed deer to be on this slide. About 3,100 deer, and again, this is when they were registered. We also have fawns that have been born in the past 6 months or so. They haven't been added into this total yet. They're not required to have that information to me yet. The map on the right, you can see the distribution of those farms across the state. And in general, they follow sort of a northwest to southeast trend along our transition zone where we do have our highest deer densities across the state. In terms of the DNR staff right now, it's myself as the Farm Deer Coordinator in that position. I was hired in that position in October of 22, so about 1 year ago. We also developed a position with the Law Enforcement Division of the DNR, and that was filled in July of 22. And more recently, Lieutenant Robert Haberman took over that position in August of this year, so he's the current liaison with the Enforcement Division. And his primary role, or the primary role of the Enforcement Division, is to work with our COs that we have scattered across the state. So the counties in the right in the map you see there, those are counties where we have game wardens or conservation officers, if you will, who it's a voluntary addition, so it's a collateral type duty, if you will, that they take on to do these inspections for the DNR. So again, it's the Enforcement Division is primarily that front face of the DNR doing the actual on-the-ground inspections. We also have another position that I'll be hiring soon. That would be an office staff. But right now, again, it's just two full-time staff that we have with the Farm Deer Program. In terms of accomplishments to date since July 1st, since the transition or the transfer of duties from Board of Animal Health to sole authority to the DNR, we've conducted, this slide here says 58 inspections. We're at about another 10 since I produced this slide as of a few days ago. We have had one individual who has taken advantage of the transfer of registration, the one-time allowed registration to a next of kin. And we also had one escape event occur on October 10th of a couple deer. We completed an interagency agreement with the Board of Animal Health, and this is really designed to be able to capture their expertise that they have with working with this program, working with livestock industry across the state, producers. So we're utilizing their expertise in several different areas. I'll touch on that on another slide. We have a Farm Deer webpage, which is on our DNR website. And primary focus of this webpage is to really address the business needs of producers. There's a lot of things that, as the regulatory agency of this industry, we have a lot of things that we need to do for the producer. So managing forms, death forms, CWD samples, where they need to go, things of that nature, and just general information for them. We've also worked with Dr. Peter Larson, at least initially with our consultation, something that was in the legislation that was passed, to do that annually. We went beyond that, and we're going to start doing quarterly consultation. And again, there's a lot of other venues where, you know, we do consult, you know, professionally, but this is more of a one-on-one type of situation where we can, you know, have conversations then about where we are with CWD. We also are going to be administering the herd certification program, and that's a USDA program. So we're working on an MOU right now to get that in place so that we can do that part of the regulatory oversight. So I mentioned the interagency agreement, and this is a key tool that we developed recently to sort of define some of the roles. Again, these are things that we needed some of the expertise that the Board of Animal Health brought to the table. So we're able to bring those in. Real briefly, on our side of the ledger, DNR, so we're doing all the inspections. And so this is on the primary white-tailed deer herds and the mixed white-tailed deer herds. We're doing some joint inspections with the Board of Animal Health. We have about 13 of those mixed herds, of those 117. We're doing all the inventory work, so we're getting information from the producers, what's on their property, what ear tags are in, what's the proper identification, reconciling all those data, maintaining them in a database. Any compliance issues, any violations that we see, we're handling that portion of it, civil penalties, things of that nature. And again, I mentioned the herd certification program that we're doing for the USDA as well. And then monitoring all mortality that occurs on those properties. So whether it's through a hunting type preserve or just natural mortality that occurs on the property, those are all, if appropriate, if eligible for sampling, then we monitor those CWD samples and house all those data in our database. And then again, working with the Board of Animal Health on any CWD positive herds that we might find in a captive situation. As far as the board, their responsibilities in this agreement, they're doing all the sample collection training, which is a program that they had developed. They have the materials, resources, staff that are doing training for producers and also for other agency folks who might need to collect samples that would be for determining if we have CWD in these herds. They're handling all the import and the movement, so all the movement into the state. And so they're working with producers on that, working with other state veterinarians to ensure that all the criteria are met for bringing animals either into the state of Minnesota or export out of the state. The TB and brucellosis program, that's a voluntary program that the Board of Animal Health also regulates, so producers are not required to be part of that program. And the second to the last bullet, providing training and for the program, that's critical right now in our early stages of taking over this sole responsibility again. So we're relying on them very heavily for their expertise in the program and software, and again, jointly handling CWD positive herds. So any new program like this is not without its challenges. So some of the things that we have certainly seen, you know, in the last year, but even since the transfer in July, there's a lot of confusion with producers in terms of who they need to go to. They're sending forms to the board. Do I need to send them to the DNR? You know, and so we're working with that. We're calling a lot of audibles and just making things work. Mixed herds present a challenge. The Board of Animal Health is managing that non-white-tailed deer portion. Let's say the elk in that case. We're managing the whitetail side, but they submit one inspection fee. Where does the revenue go? How is that collected? How do we manage the records that are for on that given premise that has two different species? So a lot of things that were a little bit unforeseen, but again, we're kind of calling audibles as we go and figuring it out. So just to summarize the transition, I think the Board of Animal Health, the DNR, we're working together. We're learning as we go. Calling those audibles to try to make sure that we meet the producer needs, you know, protect the health of our wild deer, but also protect the health of the farm deer, which is inextricably linked, you know, with health of other species as well. So our relationship is strong, I'll say. I think we got a very good down in the trenches relationship and leadership, you know, with the Board of Animal Health. And so I think we're doing very well in that regard and working together. So looking forward to more opportunities to share with you and the members. Chair Hansen.
Members, any questions? Chair Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question on the intra-agency agreement with the Board of Animal Health slide. Can you elaborate more about what the compliance and violations look like? How do you guys define those parameters, and if you guys work with the Board of Animal Health to define those?
Well, we... excuse me. Thank you, Representative. So again, if there is a violation on a farm, there's a number of things that we're looking for when we do inspections. There's the physical integrity of the site. Are the fences the adequate height? Do they have redundant gating systems? Is everything secure? So there's violations that could occur there. And then there's also violations that could occur relative to reporting. So they have to report mortality within 14 days. Of us. They need a form. They need to send a form and a death form or a movement. So all of the compliance, if there is an infraction or non-compliance, let's say, we're handling all of the subsequent notice of violation. And if it rises to the level of where we would actually impose a civil penalty, we're imposing that civil penalty. Now, we're also trying to maintain consistency with what was done in the past, you know, in terms of amounts and things like that for, you know, infractions. To date, we haven't had any, since the transfer of July 1st, we haven't had any notice of violations. We have an upcoming one with the escape that I mentioned. Does it answer your question, Representative?
Yes.
Any other questions? Seeing none, we'll go back to Dr. Straka on neonicotinoids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. We are going to be switching gears, so I hope everyone is ready for that. And you're coming over, which means I'm doing something wrong already. I haven't even started.
We are trying to make sure that when the presentation's occurring is that you're on camera rather than us. So,
Mr. Chair, with all respect, I'm fine if that does not happen. Like, that's okay. Thank you. While I have my IT guru up here, if I may, I don't know if I introduced myself before. I'm the Wildlife Section Manager for the Division of Fish and Wildlife within the DNR. So I'm going to give a quick two slides, just two slides, a little bit of an update on our neonicotinoid research. But I will be very transparent in that I feel like I'm the B team. I am not a researcher. I do not directly do these studies, and so certainly if there are questions, I'm happy to get that information, but I just wanted to put that out there right now. So I wanted to thank our team within DNR's research unit in the Section of Wildlife for putting these slides together for me.
So I wanted to start with just a little bit of an overview of what we've done. So three main studies that kind of led us up to today when we look at neonicotinoids in wildlife. I'm not going to talk a lot about neonics. I'm going to call them neonics because otherwise I will stumble on neonicotinoid. But certainly not going to go into too much of a detail. This is a class of insecticides that has been widely used for a variety of applications. So I'm not going to go into too much more detail than that, but I'm just going to stick with where we're at with wildlife. So in 2016 and 2017, we did conduct some work looking at exposure. So are upland birds, in particular prairie chickens and sharp-tailed grouse, are they being exposed to these compounds? And at the time, it was largely unknown. And we found, in fact, that yes. Looking throughout spring and fall seasons in both of these species, we had a high prevalence of exposure rates. In other words, we were finding that these birds, the tissues in these birds, the organs in these birds, we're testing positive for the presence of neonicotinoid compounds. So 76% to 93% of birds that we tested in either the spring or the fall, depending on species, did test positive for exposure. Now, I will say, though, while that can be staggering and certainly a little stark in terms of the numbers, we did not know at that time, that study was not able to talk about what impacts is that having, right? So these birds are being exposed. But is that killing them? Is it hurting them? Are we seeing morbidity or mortality? Are we seeing any other individual or population impacts? That study could not determine at the time. It was just to look at exposure. So fast forward a little bit to 2019. There was some work that was done in South Dakota, and I know we've talked at this committee before about this, but there was some work coming out of South Dakota that looked at captive white-tailed deer and a couple of compounds that are neonicotinoids, and was finding high rates of fawn mortality, again, in these captive populations in South Dakota. And so the question became, are we seeing exposure in our white-tailed deer, free-ranging white-tailed deer? Are they being exposed as well? And so in 2019, we did collect spleens from hunter-harvested deer. Again, shout out to the hunters for being willing to find a spleen. It is not exactly the most obvious tissue, so well done. But we found out of 799 spleens that were collected, again, by hunters across the state, we found that 61% of our deer tested showed exposure to neonics, and 29% of those were showing at those higher levels, the higher levels that were found in the South Dakota study that could impact some sort of fawn survival. So again, we were finding these levels, we were finding exposure, but how do you really determine that to impacting those animals themselves? Like Dr. Wolf, I think, talked about earlier, what we find in a diagnostic setting does not always replicate into real life. So again, just keep that in mind. In 2021, we drilled down a little bit, and so instead of looking at a statewide, we took those areas of the state, those deer permit areas that had either the highest or the lowest concentrations, and we divided that into three different subsets across different ecoregions of the state. So if you look at the map on the far right on your slide, you're going to see where those three sample areas were. And again, they were chosen because they're representing different ecoregions of Minnesota. So really drill down, hey, what are we seeing in the agricultural areas? What are we seeing in the more northern forested ecoregions of our state? So are we finding exposure? And absolutely we did. So that was where when we shifted that targeted sampling into those areas, you can see that we were finding it almost ubiquitous across all the ecoregions. In other words, we were finding deer tested positive up by Lake Winnebogoshish and Leech Lake and Cass Lake. We were finding deer positive there, similar to where we were in other less forested, more agricultural-based areas of the state. And so that was definitely concerning that we were seeing this exposure across the state. So moving on a little bit to what are we doing now about this, thanks to a one-time appropriation that came out of the legislature last year. It was about $943,000, if I remember it. Chair Hansen is nodding. Thank you. So we have been able to put those funds to really good use, and certainly it's a high responsibility of us as wildlife managers to make sure that we're understanding the pressures on our wildlife populations. So this is certainly, this type of work is not at all to point fingers or blame or do anything like that, but it is very important for us in order to be sound wildlife managers following the science. We need to know what inputs do we need to have in our population models? What factors do we have to consider as challenging our species at large? And so that's a big part of, I think, why we have to do this work and why it should continue. So again, looking at the slide now, continuing work. We are continuing our work with sharp-tailed grouse and prairie chicken. We have a phenomenal researcher, Dr. Charlotte Roy, who is leading that. From 2021 to 2023, we collected samples to examine the impacts
of that exposure on those birds. I talked earlier how the previous study did not determine individual or population health impacts. That's what she's intending to do now, to really look at impacts based on survival and reproduction in those birds. This work was made possible with the appropriation I talked about before, a combination of LCCMR and heritage enhancement funding. We will have final results available and expected by FY26. Moving forward, back to white-tailed deer, we are looking at, certainly we did some of the spleen work, and I know people talk about the spleen studies, and everybody just likes to say the word spleen because it's kind of an entertaining word, but how do we look at samples maybe in live animals, right? So if we're gonna capture a deer, can we collect blood, and can we determine any neonicotinoid exposure in blood? Could we determine it from urine? Could we determine it from feces? Because, man, that's a lot easier sample to collect. Trust me, a lot fewer needles. So we really want to evaluate, can we determine the levels of neonicotinoid exposure in free-ranging white-tailed deer with anamortem samples or samples that we can even collect from the environment? So we have, again, another wonderful researcher. They are not paying me to say that. Dr. Eric Mitchell will be looking at that work, and that is with heritage enhancement funds. It is using roadkill deer, so we will not be asking hunters to collect feces, although they did it with spleen, so I'm pretty sure feces is easier to find. Finally, those results are expected fiscal year 24 and 25. Finally, two future studies that are currently in planning stages are looking at spruce grouse to evaluate possible routes of exposure, and those results are also expected FY25. Those are actually using some banked feather samples that we have, so that's going to be really new cutting-edge technology looking for exposure there. And then we were lucky enough to bring on a new researcher by the name of Dr. Stephen Woodley. He's phenomenal, and he's going to be looking a little bit at ringneck pheasant and better understanding some of the ecosystem impacts. So can we look at arthropods, forbs, which are a type of plant, soils, and other things in the environment, and how these dynamics interplay together? That work's going to be conducted on our state wildlife management areas, and those results will be expected FY27. Do not have a final cost for that yet, but we are working closely with the Department of Agriculture because they are also very interested in exposure routes. So with that, I think that was all I had for you, and I appreciate the opportunity for an update.
We have several questions. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're not surprised to hear from me. you're gonna sense a theme from me because I want to talk a little bit about health in the neonics. So when someone is butchering or hunting an animal, do we have any guidance to them, or do we have any knowledge at all whether or not they can be harmed?
Dr. Strachan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, and that's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't know if I have the best answer. So one of the challenges we have with neonicotinoids as a class of insecticides is that, as I mentioned before, they're broadly used and have been for quite some time because of the recognition that there was believed to be very low toxicity to mammals. So when we start looking at some of this work of exposure to birds and mammals, this is new. So to my knowledge, I don't know if we know of any sort of thresholds for terms of consumption or how anything like that might transfer if we were to consume an animal with high exposure. I don't know. Certainly, maybe somebody else in this room does, but I don't know offhand. But we certainly will work, and we have been working closely with the Department of Health and Human Services, as we do, especially with things like mercury consumption in fish or any other consumption advisories. That's really who we lean to for what are the concerning levels here. I hope that answered your question.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if this is something we can look into just a little bit more in terms of the levels that a person possibly is consuming. Do we know anything? Just because, and thank you for your answer, just because we don't have results doesn't mean that it's 100% safe. So thank you.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for being here. I have some questions about how, and maybe this is the results of the study that we're doing, how are things like grouse or deer exposed to neonicotinoids? Like, how does it go from being an insecticide to being present at a high volume in a deer spleen? How does that happen to a deer?
Dr. Straka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. So the question was about exposure routes that we know of, and I can tell you that some of the work that Dr. Roy had done back in that 2016-2017 study looking at the Sharpies, as they're affectionately known, sharp-tailed grouse and prairie chicken, really documented the widespread availability of some neonicotinoids on treated seeds that are used in the landscape. And so I mentioned earlier that this class of insecticides, it's used in everything from garden pest control products to what you may put on your pets for flea and tick control, to certainly some seed coatings that are put on the landscape for either agricultural practices or even just potentially some different seeding efforts. And so that study in 2016 and 2017 documented that numerous species of granivorous wildlife, those wildlife that eat consume grains, were being exposed, were taking up some of these seeds on the landscape. And so we know that that's certainly a possible route of exposure. But again, when we start looking at areas that do not have use of treated seeds on the landscape, certainly some of those northern forested ecoregions, where are they being exposed? And that's where some of this other additional work is hoping to figure out some more of these routes of exposure, especially in things like spruce grouse.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your knowledge, have there been any other studies that have been done to determine neonicotinoid exposure in animals that are carnivorous or omnivorous or do not eat grain?
Dr. Straka.
Oh, Mr. Chair, that's a good one. To my knowledge, there was some research in 2019 that was looking at exposure levels in otters, fisher, and bobcats. And I don't remember offhand what those results were. I just know that work was being done, and I can look into that and see what. Yeah, she's nodding. I can definitely get that information for you. And I promise you right now, our researchers are like, come on. But I can follow up with that and provide it to the committee.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. Are neonicotinoids naturally occurring in our environment in Minnesota?
Dr. Straka.
That's a great question. Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great question as well, Representative Jordan. I don't know if there are any naturally occurring neonicotinoid compounds. It is such a big umbrella that I can't say for certain if we have any naturally ones or if they're all synthetic.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It might be a good time to note that Ms. Becca Nash is here from the LCCMR and that there will be a request for proposals for research projects that the commission will probably adopt the RFP in the next month. So those of you who are looking for research opportunities, it might be a good time. Ms. Jordan, I think Representative Jordan, too, the hunters and anglers in Minnesota pursue a lot of game. And so it's not just the deer and the pheasant. It's a waterfowl. So Dr. Straka, would we have to work, because of those are migratory birds, would we be working with other states or, let's say, doing research on ducks and geese? Would there be additional requirements there, or can we pursue that type of research on our own?
That's a great question, Mr. Chair. We are, and members of this committee may be aware, but we have been looking at other compounds that are used for a variety of purposes, like PFAS. We have been looking at those in waterfowl. And so if the thought is we want to start looking for neonicotinoids in waterfowl, we have already started doing some of that line of testing for other compounds. And so we already have, I think, processes in place and able to do that.
And then for anglers, we have different types of fish that Minnesotans pursue. So we have the trout streams, maybe susceptible to runoff, lakes. Any work being done looking at fish and neonics?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know offhand if our fisheries research unit has been doing anything in fish with neonics, but I can certainly follow up with this committee, too, to make sure that everyone knows.
And then finally, we have a non-game program. Is there any work done there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question about whether or not anyone is looking at non-game species for exposure to neonicotinoids, that's a very popular field. I think when we look at impacts to pollinators, especially I know in Minnesota we've talked a lot about the rusty patch bumblebee and the relationship with neonicotinoids. So yes, there's been quite a lot of work with pollinators, quite a lot of work in birds, passerine birds especially. But I don't know of any specific active studies. But again, I'd be happy to follow up, and somebody significantly more informed about that can come talk to you as well. I'd be happy to help with that.
Bird seed's a pretty big market, I think. And again, I would note that Ms. Nash is here if anybody has any questions on the process for applying for grants. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, Dr. Eric Jopp, Board of Animal Health. We are running a little over, but Chair Dupuy from the Fond du Lac Band will not be with us today, so we had a little extra time. Welcome. And state your name for the record. And members, the handouts are in your packets, as well as those that are participating online. They are posted on the website. I should note, we had the University of Minnesota researchers talking about CWD. There also is a fact sheet posted how to use biosecurity to protect your CERVID operation against CWD from the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Dr. Job.
Chair Hansen and committee members, good morning and thank you for inviting us to present at this meeting. I am Dr. Eric Jopp, Assistant Director of the Board of Animal Health, where I oversee all board programs. With me is Dr. Heather D'Amico, Senior Veterinarian in charge of Farmed CERVID Program at the board. I'll give a brief overview of and updates of the program as it is today, and will be open for questions while completed. As was presented previously by the DNR, the Board of Animal Health is in charge of farmed non-white-tailed deer CERVIDs within the state. Currently, we have 89 non-white-tailed deer herds, consisting mainly of elk, with 68 elk herds, 9 reindeer, 4 fallow deer, 1 red deer, 1 sika, 1 muntjac, and 5 mixed species herds. Within these herds, there are approximately 3,100 animals. Along with these herds, we work with the DNR on somewhere on 16 mixed white-tailed deer herds. That number has been changing daily. As mentioned earlier, Dr. Heather D'Amico, who is with me, is the program director for Farm CERVIDs. Along with her, we have Addie Evans, the Farm CERVID program lead. We also have about 20 field staff consisting of Board of Animal Health employees, as well as USDA field personnel that conduct all of the CERVID inspections throughout the year. The map on the right-hand side of the slide somewhat depicts where our staff are located throughout the state. We are currently setting up interviews for another office position that will assist with the program. As of last week, our staff have completed 56 of the 2023 inspections with 51 remaining. These numbers are typical for this time of year, as most inspections occur towards the fall and winter when it is easier for field inspectors to complete and the farmers tend to be working their animals. We have received 145 CWD test submissions to date, and there are currently no CWD positive CERVIDs in Minnesota. All animals that die on farms or are slaughtered are tested for CWD. The last positive herd was in Winona County that was completely depopulated last fall. Some of the bigger program updates include the cooperative agreement with USDA for a research project has been extended through September 29 of 2024. This research is looking into genomically estimated breeding values, is looking specifically at the genetic makeup of the animals and the probability that they could become infected if exposed to CWD. We will also have a producer portal for farmers to submit their data online into our system to streamline the entire entry process. This is scheduled to be phased in around the first of the year. Registrations for the renewal of Farm CERVID are due December 31st of this year. Board of Animal Health and the DNR jointly maintain the Minnesota Herd Certification Program with the USDA, with the board taking the main responsibility. As stated earlier, the white-tailed deer program has been transferred to the DNR with an interagency agreement signed between these agencies. That agreement will be looked at for needed updates in mid-November. We have seen an increase in export movements for all cervid species, which has increased our in-office workload. We have also noted that there is a need for more certified CWD sample collectors with a training in the near future. We did have one escaped elk on the 11th of this month in Todd County, and as of this morning, it is still at large with the producer actively working on locating and capturing the animal, and a reward is being offered by the farmer. So thank you again for the opportunity to present the efforts of the Board of Animal Health in cooperation with the DNR with the Farm Cervid Program.
Thank you, Dr. Jopp. We can now go proceed to member questions for the Board of Animal Health. Any member questions? Any online? Oh, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I had a question on is I noticed that you folks were mentioning that there's no current CWD positive farm cervids in Minnesota. So does that mean that the past farms that were CWD positive, had they all been depopulated?
Yes, committee members, Chair. All of the farms that have been positive have been depopulated. That's actually in statute. So they have been depopulated, with the last one being in, I believe it was October of last year.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. And for those that were depopulated then, does fencing remain in place, and if so, for how long, to make sure that there isn't wild deer going into those areas?
Dr. Jopp.
Chair and committee, yes, their fencing is maintained. It was previously 5 years, and then new legislation has been changed to 10 years. So that has the fencing is maintained, and it is inspected on a yearly basis.
Any other questions? How is the transfer going from the Board of Animal Health's perspective?
Chair and committee, I would say on the perspective of the board, the transfer has been going well. We do have a good working relationship with the members at the DNR. We do have weekly meetings with as many of our staff members there as possible. And office staff are meeting much more frequently than that, working through, as Dave said, some of the gray areas where there's some interpretation to be done. But I would say, as a whole, it's been working fairly well.
And, you know, you've been in the audience during the earlier part of this. The efforts working with other states and around the country and around the world, actually, how is your relationship with other states, and are you plugged into that effort?
Chair and committee, yes. There are efforts around the country in many different states. There was actually just a national conference in Washington, D.C. that Dr. D'Amico was present at, and there was many talks about CWD and what's going on around the country. With our herd certification program, we are in close relation with members of USDA and what is going on around the country and what updates are being done as well.
Great. Any other questions? Anyone online? Thank you. Next up, we will have a series of updates on implementation of some of the provisions that were passed earlier this spring. First up is the Metropolitan Council, Ned Smith, on inflow infiltration. Welcome, and state your name for the record.
Good morning, Chair Hansen and members of the committee. Did you want to help me put this in presentation mode? I don't know if anyone cares if I'm exporting a PDF. That's better. My name is Ned Smith. I am the Director of Pretreatment and Finance for Environmental Services at the Metropolitan Council. I'm here to give an update on the appropriations on inflow and infiltration. Just a brief reminder for what is inflow and infiltration. It's the short answer is leaky pipes. It's either rainwater or other water getting into the sewer or storm water pipes that then flows to the plants. And we don't like to pay to clean water because it's already clean. So we try to keep the pipe sealed so that doesn't get to us. It can also be a leaky pipe in that the sewage leaks out into the ground, which is also detrimental to the environment. And can also cause backups into basements and whatnot. So just a reminder for in the last session, there was $2.75 million was appropriated to the city of Newport to work on inflow and infiltration in their sanitary sewer disposal system. So I'm primarily here today to give you an update on that. Edits that go back and forth here. We had scheduled a meeting in October. It was canceled, but then that happened late last week. So we're very happy to have some progress to report here. What we wanted to cover with them is eligible and proposed work, how we want to think about grant agreements and the process overview. And I know it was very important to this committee that they have minimal administration requirements for those processes. Because this is an appropriation, we will not be using the standard INI bonding language that we use. So it should be a streamlined process in terms of agreements and reimbursements. We also wanted to talk through any preliminary work or what their identified projects were. And so we met on Thursday with the city administrator, city engineer, public works supervisor, and then Kyle Colden, our manager of planning. So they have projects already identified. The biggest one and the number one priority is their Second Avenue large sewer trunk. They are refurbishing that street, and they're going to do kind of soup to nuts that trunk. So the total project is $7 million, but $1.3 million of that has to do with the sewer. A couple of components of that, in addition to standard I&I work that you would do on a replacement, there are some private service laterals that are in the street that are they're going to have to tear up and repair. Normally that gets touchy because we can't use bond money for private I&I, but this is not bond money. So we are working with our lawyers, but we are pretty confident that we can use this funding to help with the replacement of those private service ladders that are in the public right away. The other interesting twist on this is this work is going to include some sewer work and storm management. This road right now doesn't have curbs, and so it doesn't manage stormwater. So water collects in puddles and pools and then seeps into the ground and seeps into the pipes. This is going to include some storm management tools that should therefore reduce the I&I that comes into our system. So we believe that we might have some eligibility there as well. Also, they're looking at some older parts of the city that are very susceptible to river flooding. So river flooding is bad, not only because it floats on the street, but that also can raise the water table and get into the pipes that way. So we are exploring some of those repairs, and that will also be eligible for the work. It's a little early for exact dollar estimates for all of these, so we are continuing to work with the city to get those nailed down. But I see no concerns with getting this implemented by the 2026 deadline. And then just another reminder, we do have the inflow and infiltration grants that were part of the bonding program. That was for $12 million. That is progressing well. We were working internally on getting our portal updated so that they can do a lot of their work online. They could submit the work online and get reimbursed online. And then we will have a kickoff with our 80 eligible communities in November to get that work started. At the same time, we are just about wrapping up 2020. I think we have about one or two more letters and checks to get out. So we want to make sure to get that wrapped up as well as kicking off this program. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Members, any questions? Ms. Taylor, I think we passed some affordability requirements with I&I.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe that was carried in the capital investment area. I know I did do some preliminary work, and I don't know the final disposition of that, but there may be.
Mr. Smith, anything on affordability, trying to make sure we're reaching people who need to be reached?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the council. So for the 2023 bond, there were not specific guidelines outlined, but we heard from members that that was important. We will be looking at property tax or property tax capacity per capita, and identifying which cities then have kind of the hardest time investing in their infrastructure. So we will allocate it out that way.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Smith. Have you or the Met Council worked at all with the Public Facilities Authority on paying for any of this, and then why or why not?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you for the question, Vice Chair Jordan. Yes, we have. We work with PFA every year, and we do about $45 to $50 million per year in our plants and interceptor work. The eligibility for I&I is, to my knowledge, is not part of the PFA outline for what their funding is. It's primarily around, at least on the clean water side, around plants and interceptors.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Smith. Just one final follow-up question. Has that been impacted at all by the work you're doing around eligibility based on income as we're with your work with PFA?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, off the top of my head, I know they did modify their scoring a little bit, so they have a scoring matrix based on the work that you're doing. However, for us, that usually doesn't come up as one of the our projects typically don't focus on those areas of low income. We focus on area of need. If there's a rotted pipe, we just want to fix it. So there may, I can't speak for how the PFA changed their guidelines, but for us, we were still able to get about $45 to $50 million in projects approved, which I believe is about a third of what they offer. Just one more thing, Chair Hansen. The other complication there is we're kind of a wholesaler. So we serve the 111 customer communities in the region. So we can only kind of work on our stuff in terms of PFA. We can't represent the 111 cities to do work in a specific city on their infrastructure.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Next
up, Tom Johnson, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Climate Resiliency Grants and Cumulative Impact. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hopefully that's working. Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Tom Johnson, Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Happy to be here to provide a bit of an update on a few key priority items. Want to again thank the committee for the work this last session on these really key shared priorities. As you mentioned, Mr. Chair, I'll go over very briefly here some of the updates on resilient communities grants and cumulative impacts rulemaking. But as you'll see, I did sneak in a little update on PFAS as well, because we've been thinking about our key priority implementation priorities. Really, you know, these three items have been at the top of the list, especially as we're updating the governor's office on as we're proceeding. So first of all, on the resilient communities grants item, again, this was, as a reminder, $100 million was one of the key highest profile items coming out of the climate subcabinet and that interagency work group to identify the biggest priorities to implement from the climate action framework here in Minnesota. As far as implementation, we've already released two RFPs for initial grant funding opportunities. These have largely been just for planning grants so far, building off the work of previous appropriations from this committee to ensure we have those that planning work in place before we move to large implementation dollars. And that those implementation dollars could, of course, come from this $100 million here, but also from federal funds that are available through the Inflation Reduction Act. So that first round of funding was $500,000. That was for small communities in particular. We wanted to give them a chance to apply for we wanted to give them a chance to apply before we went to and made it available to all communities. Underscoring the need, I think, was we had over double that amount of applications for that $500,000. So definitely the need is out there, and this is just the first of many rounds of funding for this. The second round here is $750,000 that opened, I believe, just last week, and that will be for all communities to start down this road of planning. For cumulative impacts, the MPCA has 36 months as defined by the legislature in statute to complete this rulemaking or at least get to an intent to adopt. So we have started down that process with vigor. We've conducted our first series of public meetings in all the affected areas. So that would we did a virtual option, a couple here in the metro area, and then one in Duluth, one in Rochester. We will be, we also put out an initial request for comments. That was open from July 24th up until October 6th. So we gave it quite a bit of time to receive initial public comments and comments from interested parties. That we will be holding a follow-up meeting to go over those comments on November 14th, and that'll be a virtual public meeting, so available to the public and, of course, to members of the committee. As we move into PFAS, we have just opened $22 million of funding for planning and design of PFAS treatment systems for owners and operators of community drinking water supply systems in Minnesota. Applications are currently being accepted on a rolling first-come, first-served basis. So those are going to be four communities that already have four quarters of sampling with the Department of Health, showing they're over the health guidance limits. Of course, those health guidance limits are going to lower very soon as the federal government finalizes their proposed maximum contaminant levels, those enforceable drinking water standards. So we're expecting a lot of need there, and of course, following up with that $22 million, we will be coming to the legislature with some capital investment asks along that regard as well. And then, of course, Amara's Law, we're in our initial phases of implementing that. We have two requests for comments open for rulemakings related to the reporting requirements for manufacturers and then also the associated fee mechanism for the agency to receive fees applicable to that. Public comments are currently being accepting on those, and the ban on intentionally added PFAS in 11 specific product categories goes into effect January 2025. The final item, just want to make sure to draw the committee's attention to and members of the public, is we have landing pages for all three of these items. We know they're high priority pieces and of interest to the public and community, so we have great landing pages that our communications team put together on each of these pieces that will take you to the corresponding requests for comments as they may apply for those rule opportunities, and then also easily allow communities to apply for those grant opportunities as they become available for the climate resilient communities grants. That's it for me. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for being here. I'm glad that the MPCA is doing a lot of comment periods. However, I've heard a lot of issues from constituents who have had enormous difficulty actually submitting comments, particularly online. And the people who I've most heard these from are people who do not speak English as their first language and senior citizens, which are also two of the demographic groups that our cumulative impact work is designed to protect their health. So I guess I know that I reached out to the MPCA about this, but what are you doing differently with these other upcoming comment periods to ensure that people's comments are actually being able to be submitted online?
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Jordan, that's a great question. The MPCA has put a lot of stock and a lot of resources into developing our own comment system. We use a comment system called Smart Comment for the items that we're able to do on our own web page. Unfortunately, for the formal rulemaking process, we do have to use the Office of Administrative Hearings web page, which I have heard there have been a lot of difficulties accessing. So there's not a ton we can do about that. Although, you know, we've made sure that folks have access to the Office of Administrative Hearings FAQ, and we've even walked individuals through that process where we can, but that's a very time-intensive process to talk to every individual and try to walk them through how to use that page. But I recognize it there are some difficulties there, and I'm hopeful there will be some attention to that in the future.
Representative Jordan.
And one follow-up. I guess I had a constituent that was told to go to a library and use a fax machine. Like, this isn't a joke. I don't know what a fax machine is. Like, is there one at my library? I have no idea. That's not actually actionable. Like advice on how to submit a comment. And particularly when we're talking about our EJ communities, which we have defined as people who are under-resourced, who maybe don't speak English as their first language, who have physical or mental disabilities, I think we can do more. And so I would hope to see at our next update the MPCA talk about having things like in-person meetings, even if they're smaller ones. You know, Rochester is not accessible for the EJ community that I represent, and nor is an inaccessible place in St. Paul, actually, for that matter. And so making sure that we are meeting our EJ communities who this law was written for, where they're at, is something that's pretty critical. We're also, I mean, as we look at things like our air quality monitoring, like making sure that that's in a place where people who are actually impacted by this pollution can comment on this and not have to, you know, if they have mobility issues, go to a library and try to figure out what a fax machine is. It is going to be really important. So I'm hoping we can take this feedback, because I heard not just from one constituent, not just from two constituents, but a handful and multiple constituents, which indicates to me that my constituents are intensely interested in this and want to comment. I don't normally, we do comment periods all the time in government, and with the exception of things like protecting the boundary waters, canoe area wilderness, I don't normally hear from constituents on comment periods, but I did on this one. And I think that's both concerning and something to celebrate. So I guess it's great that there were enough people knew about this comment period that they wanted to comment. Where we fell short was actually allowing people to comment on issues that impact their own lungs and their own water they drink. So I'm hoping we can see some changes. Maybe we need to address this with the Department of Administration, but it is an issue. And so I'm hoping we can make some strides on improving that.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for those comments, Representative. I think we really do want to make this as accessible as possible, and those public meetings were not they were not just in Rochester and Duluth. We had several here in the Twin Cities as well, in North Minneapolis, one in St. Paul, but we had at least two in the Twin Cities and a virtual option for folks as well for those public meetings. So we are really trying to make those accessible, and for those official comment processes, we can't receive those by email. You know, that's why I think with that one particular constituent, I think I know who you're talking about, and what it was coming down to the last hours, and
yeah.
You know, the website wasn't working for them, and the last option was fax, and I recognize that's not a really useful option these days. But anyway, thanks for those comments. We'll take those to heart.
Any other questions? I would just note, too, there are EJ communities in the first-tier suburbs, not just Minneapolis and St. Paul. Mm-hmm. So maybe next time there are meetings, they can reach out into some of the counties. A couple just quick things, Mr. Johnson, and they're on other pieces that we passed in the bill. Just checking on the work done on disposal for the treated seed, if you have any update, and you can follow up afterwards on that, and then the odor statute as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as I know, the treated seed, we still remain confident that we understand the boundaries. I know that I'll have to get you an update if and I'll speak with the Department of Agriculture on where the rulemaking is at there. But I think we feel like that's a pretty easy distinction to make, and we've figured out most of that. It's mostly just codifying it into rule. The as far as the odor regulations, I think we're recognizing that we may need a little bit more resources to for rulemaking staff, just given the large strain on our rulemaking staff with the cumulative impacts, air toxics, PFAS rules are very big endeavors. And so we may be coming back to the legislature to look for some additional resources in that area. If we want to accomplish the odor rules in a quick time frame, as it stands, it'll probably be several years as we try to accomplish all these rules at once. If there's no additional resources, so that's the update on odor. But we feel like we have a path forward on that as well.
Mr. Hagemeyer, how much we put money in the base for that, didn't we?
Mr. Chair, I don't have it right in front of me, but I believe it was $250,000 per year ongoing from the general fund. I'm looking at the agency for confirmation of that.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and thank you. I believe it was a one-time appropriation. Several things, of course, moved into one time. I believe it was $500,000, $250,000 in '24 and $250,000 in '25, but I'll wait for Mr. Hagemeyer to confirm.
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, maybe just give me a minute and I'll get back to you.
As he's doing that, Chair Lee is not here, but I know he has expressed some concern. You know, we're on the capital investment tours, and there are a large amount of requests for wastewater PFAS issues. And so the concern about the public having to pay for the cleanup cost here versus the, and so we had put that provision in on cost recovery, any, on that study, any updates on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe the process has how that will unfold is we will have our internal work group as was directed to us by the legislature between ourselves and MMB and revenue to look at some mechanisms, and then we'll bring that to a likely a small group to get feedback, and then once we've received that feedback, we'll have another crack at it and release a final. I believe it's February 15th that's due to the committee, so hoping to get that turned around in that timeline.
Mr. Hagemeyer.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the bill in front of me here. It's $250,000 the first year and $250,000 the second year for rulemaking and implementation of the odor management requirements under Minnesota Statute 116.064. So it doesn't specify one time, so it would be ongoing based funding of $250,000 per year.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up, Emerald Ash Borer Grants. Valerie McClanahan, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. We have the flexibility to go a little bit over, but not a lot. So we're gonna go relatively quick.
I don't want to keep you from lunch. I know that's coming up. How are y'all this morning?
Great.
Good. think I'm sharing yet.
And maybe Dr. Straka, if you want to move up as well so we can go quickly to you right afterwards.
Am I sharing? I don't think I am.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's working.
I'm good. Oh, good. Sorry. It's hard to, the pillars are perfectly aligned to not see the screens. Hi, everybody. Good morning. My name is Valerie McClanahan. I'm the Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator at the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you so much for having me, Mr. Chair and representatives. Here today to talk to you about Emerald Ash Borer and the EAB grants that we received from the legislature this last year. So I want to just do a quick look back in time. We've been talking about this for a number of years now, but Minnesota has nearly 1 billion ash throughout the entire state of Minnesota, and within our community forests, 1 in 5 trees, or 20% of the trees in our communities as of 2010, were ash. Some of these communities had up to 60% of their trees in their community being ash. EAB kills 99.9% of all ash trees, and it can kill saplings down to 1 inch in diameter or less. This is a big public safety concern. EAB, it's quoted, once it's infested, an ash tree has, the ash tree then has the structural integrity of a standing potato chip. We're hearing reports from folks being tree shattering on impact when they're being removed and things like that. So there's a huge concern. We're really grateful for the recent support for our communities. Our communities are really grateful for the recent support that they've received. I know that I got this in a bit late, but I do have a handout of our current status of all of the grants within the state of Minnesota. So that is out front, and there's a handful here. You know, since fiscal year 2020, we had a million in funds. Those state funds have closed. We've been able to leverage these funds simultaneously to obtain some federal funding, which has been really lovely because federally, typically there's a requirement of a one-to-one match. And so we've been able to really stretch these funds out to assist communities throughout the entire state. These funds have been able to fund tree inventories, which are a needed component of being able for these communities to actually identify where these ash are and how many they have so that they can begin developing management plans. And this funding has allowed for them to also be implementing these management plans. These funds have provided funding for removals. More recently, we have been able to fund non-neonicotinoid treatment of ash. We are planting a diverse array of species, using funds to educate residents, and more recently with the Minnesota Relief Funds, we're going to be able to help our Minnesota residents, our Minnesota low-income residents with this funding. So EAB is continuing to spread. It's certainly been at a slower rate than we had, when it arrived here in 2009, than we had initially anticipated. However, there are some recent finds in some key locations, such as Cass County, that are concerning. And so we're as it's continuing to spread, the need is just going to continue to grow. We are hearing still reports from communities that have standing dead within their community because they haven't been able to keep up with the removals. And so treatment has been a necessary component, even just to slow down so that they have either they can build up their staff capacity or be contracting out this work in order to conduct the removals needed. So the Environmental Quality Board had recommended $8.5 million every year for 30 years. This Minnesota relief funding that we recently got from the legislature was released on September 18th and closed. It opened July 31st, closed September 18th. We had over 151 applications to this funding, and over $33 million were requested for the 6.883 that we had available to fund. Similarly, with shade tree bonding, we had $10.63 million available, which funds the removal and replacement or planting of trees, and we had $17 million in requests and 72 applications. We, fiscal year 24, will have another $6.883 million available to grant out competitively to communities throughout the state, as well as nonprofit organizations. And then in fiscal year 25, we go to an ongoing of $400,000. So with that, I am open to questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Vettel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to pivot just a little bit, and I know we're talking about Emerald Ash 4, but I just want to, it's come to my understanding, you're with the DNR, so I'm hoping that you can convey this to Assistant Commissioner Richards or somebody can follow up with me. It's my understanding that there was a federal ban, and then now Twin Metals is going after Birch Lake to do some approved samples that are happening. And I know we're talking about water storage and water quality next, but I have serious concerns about what's happening here. So I just want to put it on the record in front of this committee that I know my community is very concerned about water quality. And so if you could convey that, thank you.
Any other questions? So the two grants that are out, when do you anticipate those will be released?
So we had closed the Minnesota Relief, so that had been open from July 31 to September. Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah. We closed that on September 18th. That review committee has met and selected awardees. Until they're in contract officially, it's not public information. But as soon as we have that available, we'll be in touch to let you know who was awarded and who has accepted those awards. We anticipate, we're working on getting everyone into contract as quickly as possible. Our goal is to have everyone into contract before the end of the year.
Great. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. McClanahan. Can you talk to me a little bit about how the DNR scores applications from cities? Obviously, you've demonstrated that there's much more demand than there is availability to help cities with their urban forestry. So can you talk to me about how you determine who is funded and who is not?
Absolutely, yes. So we also, thank you. I'm getting better at it. Thank you so much for your question, Mr. Chair, Representative. We have our rating rubric available online. It's a part of our request for applications, so that is available. We want to be as transparent as possible with our applicants as to how we are scoring. We have a number of different sections, including a project overview. What are they planning to do with it? Key personnel, who's going to be involved with this process. We also have a section on priority populations. So how are you meeting the needs of the most underserved in your community? We refer to the MPCA Environmental Justice Map just as a reference, but we encourage applicants, even if they're not within those zones, that they can still be addressing environmental justice within their communities. So we're working also to educate them as to what that looks like and what smart engagement can look like too. So those are some aspects that we're rating on, and then our review committee is made up of some DNR staff, as well as representative from the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee, which is our tree board, and then we also work to have municipalities who are city foresters who are maybe not applying as a part of this process to just provide us some additional feedback.
Questions online? Thank you. And Dr. Straka, we've already talked about neonics. I just asked you to come forward because I want to ask about the feral hog study and just what's happening there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is on, too. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a quick addendum for the neonicotinoid. I will not go through slideshow, but to get to your question about consumption advisories. So I did hear from our wildlife health program. I recognize we're over time, but the Minnesota Department of Health believes that there is likely to be little to no human health risk associated with consuming venison from deer that may have been exposed to neonicotinoids. Our study tested deer spleen samples and found the preliminary results for spleen samples from deer that we tested were far below the EPA's allowable neonicotinoid residue levels for common fruits or cattle meat. So I hope that addressed some of your questions. Absolutely can follow up more as needed, Mr. Chair. To get to your question about the feral swine and mink report, yes. So I'm an executive sponsor on that project. We are on timeline to have the finished draft or the finished report back to this committee by February of 2024. Partners have met once already. We will be meeting a second time as a project team tomorrow. Looking to have a public meeting that will allow for public comment period in mid-November. That will be, as of right now, will be hosted by DNR, and I believe it's going to be WebEx, which will allow for sort of anonymous question submissions, as well as email comments will be taken for that report. The report will focus on roles and responsibilities of all the agencies between the Board of Animal Health, Department of Agriculture, Department of Natural Resources, those three agencies, and our current approach right now to how we handle loose swine in the landscape as well as farmed or captive mink. We will be having a communications plan that was also part of that requirement that will include key info for each of these agencies as well as providing information directly to stakeholders and how that's going to be communicated. So we are hoping to have the draft to the project team of that report by November 22nd. So again, that'll be following the public meeting and allow for incorporation of any comments at that time. So as of right now, that's the brief update on that report.
Great. Any questions, members? I think the DNR did a good job of getting us like the EAB grant opportunities, and also I saw press releases. If any of the agencies, when there are grant opportunities or when there are public input opportunities, if you can get those to the committee so that we can send them out so that people are aware of them, and we all have email updates that we can share or Facebook to get the information out. I think members would be happy to get that. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And finally, Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, Angela Fish, water storage and lawns to legumes. We save the best for last.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Let's see. One of these is mine. I found it. I'm going to do my very best to be brief and quick. Members of the committee, my name is Andrea Fish, and I'm here today on behalf of the Board of Water and Soil Resources to give those brief updates on water storage and lawns to legumes. And I want to restate our mission is to improve and protect Minnesota's water and soil resources by working in partnership with local organizations and private landowners. Our water quality and storage program is a program that provides financial assistance to local units of government to help them control water volume and rates, improve water quality and related public benefits, and to mitigate the impacts of climate change. The priority that has been in statute has been toward the Minnesota River Basin and the lower Mississippi River Basin in Minnesota. When it comes to water storage implementation, we have both natural and mechanical approaches to water storage, so that includes everything from retention structures and basins, as well as acquisition of flowage rights, working on infiltration, wetland restoration, creation or enhancement, channel restoration or enhancement, and floodplain restoration or enhancement. Last summer, we had three projects totaling a little over 843,000 dollars, and starting this summer in 2023, we had three applications fully funded of approximately 1.7 million that used part of that fiscal year 2024 and 2025 funding. The recipients include the Bois de Soulis Watershed District and Area 2 Minnesota River Basin projects, with three grants total. And for our lawns to legumes program, this is the program that was initially established under funding from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund through the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. Started with a $900,000 funding in 2019 and has continued to grow since that time. The program has three major components in terms of our efforts to restore pollinator habitat in Minnesota via public education and outreach, individual landowner support, and demonstration neighborhoods that provide for larger habitat installation projects. We've had nearly 4,000 funded projects since 2019 with over 5 million square feet planted in native habitat. We will continue to award an additional 2,000 or more individual support grants for spring and later summer cohorts through that new funding. And we continue to recruit and train additional coaches. And I actually do have some numbers. I hope they are with you, and if not, I will get them to you. But we have established 32 demonstration neighborhoods and corridors in the state. We've had over 6,000 people attending habitat workshops and webinars. Our website visits that we use are the most popular of all of Bowser's websites, over 400,000 individual site visits where folks are not only using the resources we have, but then sharing their inspired plantings with us and getting those added to maps. We've also had 140 volunteer coaches that continue to increase, and we continue to train and recruit additional coaches for that ongoing outreach and continued pollinator habitat restoration.
Members, any questions? Oh, we have one online. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Fish, for the presentation. I guess I'm wondering, with the success and the growth of this program, for lawns to legumes, excuse me, specifically. Is there kind of a next step that you all are envisioning? Is it sort of continuing on the path that you have already blazed? I'm particularly interested in like the neighborhoods and looking at, you know, kind of that next scale up from just individual yards, or is there thinking about kind of what the next phase may look like in this program?
Dr. Fish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell. We are actually in the process of going over some of the analytics that we have in terms of applications we've received and interest we've received compared to what we're able to fund. In addition, we have the new Habitat Friendly Utilities program that was just funded this past year, and we're working with Minnesota utility companies, analyzing opportunities along solar farms and along utility transmission and distribution corridors to see what sort of opportunities there are. So we're in a big study phase of what is the demand, what are the opportunities, so that we can meet the goals of the current funding and keep you updated on what demand, what unmet demand there might additionally be that we can continue to address.
Representative Purcell.
That is all. Thank you.
And Director Fish, I seem to remember a number of 17,000 applicants for lawns and legumes. Is that correct, or has that grown? Or?
Mr. Chair, that has grown. We have over 20,000 applicants so far for the program.
I think that would make it the most popular environmental program we have created in years, if not decades. Any other questions? Probably a good note to finish on. Members, session does not start until February. We anticipate a possible joint hearing with taxes on the public lands impacts of the Tyler decision that was removed from the agenda today. I think it's important, we've passed a lot of legislation to keep following up and checking on things, and so as we do that, we want to make sure we share that with the members and share that with our members, share it with their constituents. So we've done a lot, but there's more to do. And I think particularly the lawns and legumes, the water storage, and the trees program show that there's a huge demand still out there for these programs. And all it takes is driving around the state to see the ash trees that have died that are going to need to be taken down and replanted. So I'm hopeful we have a strong tree initiative coming into the next year. So with that, we are adjourned.